MyAudiobooks.ai presents The River the Federal Government Just Took Back, Inside the Colorado Water Takeover. On October 1st, 2026, 19 days from the writing of this article, the Colorado River will be governed for the first time in its modern history, not by an agreement among the seven states that share it, but by the federal government acting alone. In August, the Department of the Interior issued a record of decision that reads like a quiet constitutional event. After years of negotiation, missed deadlines, and a final impasse between the states of the Upper Basin and the Lower Basin, the seven states failed to agree on how to divide the shrinking river after the old rules expired in 2026. So the federal government picked up the pen. The pen the states were supposed to be holding. A 10-year decision framework now governs the river, opening with mandatory cuts of 1.25 million acre-feet of water per year taken from Arizona, California, and Nevada, roughly a fifth of the lower basin supply, with no mandatory cuts at all for the upper basin states, and provisions for the cuts to deepen toward 3 million acre-feet if the reservoirs keep falling. Within days, Nevada and its water authorities sued. The Colorado is the hardest-working river in America. It supplies 40 million people, 4 million acres of farmland, 30 tribal nations, 2 countries, and the cities of Los Angeles, Phoenix, Las Vegas, San Diego, Denver, Salt Lake City, Albuquerque, and Tijuana. And for 104 years, it has been governed by a lie told in 1922. The Colorado River Compact, the founding document of Western water law, divided the river's flow among the states in quantities that were larger than the river's actual water. The negotiators of the compact allocated some 16.5 million acre-feet a year on the basis of a few unusually wet years of data. The long-term average flow of the river is closer to 13.5 million. And in the 21st century, amid the driest quarter millennium the basin has seen in 1,200 years, it has run lower still. The river was overpromised at birth. The reservoirs built to hide that fact, Meade and Powell, the two largest in the country, which together can hold 4 years of the river's flow, have spent 26 years draining toward their minimum operating levels, making the overpromise impossible to paper over any longer. The unit all of this is measured in deserves a physical picture, because the entire fight happens in acre feet. 1 acre foot is the water covering 1 acre of land to a depth of 1 foot, about 326,000 gallons. Roughly what 3 average American households use in a year. The whole Colorado carries about 13.5 million of those units in an average year now, and the rules divide every one of them at least twice. The largest single share does not go to any city. It goes to farms. Roughly 8 in every 10 acre feet drawn from the river become alfalfa, hay, cotton, and produce, including most of America's winter vegetables grown in desert valleys irrigated with river water. This is why every honest conversation about cuts eventually reaches the same fence. Cities can conserve impressively and barely move the ledger, while a few weeks of fallowed fields in the Imperial Valley move millions of acre feet. The hardest question in basin politics is not how much water to save. It is whose fields stop drinking, and who pays them for the thirst. The old rules, the interim guidelines written in 2007, were the scaffolding that let the states keep pretending the math worked. Those rules expire in 2026, and the states could not write their replacement. That failure, not the drought, not the reservoirs, is the story of this August. This article is about what happens when a 100-year-old constitutional arrangement for sharing a river finally runs out of river. And the interesting part is not the water. It is the governance. What collapsed this year was not a water supply. The cuts were always coming, and every hydrologist in the basin has known their approximate shape for a decade. What collapsed was a century-old system in which seven sovereign states were supposed to allocate scarcity among themselves by consensus and couldn't. The question the decision framework answers, temporarily, is who decides now? The question it leaves open is whether the answer can survive the courts, the politics of the Upper Basin's free pass, and the arithmetic of a river that keeps shrinking underneath whoever holds the pen. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create your own audiobooks from prompts, turn your documents into audio, all with one subscription, and store your items in your own personal library. To understand what actually failed, you have to understand the machinery that was supposed to prevent this. The law of the river is not one law, but a century of compacts, treaties, court decisions, and operating rules layered on the Compact of 1922, and its central bargain was always geographic. Underneath the bargain sits the West's oldest water doctrine, prior appropriation, first in time, first in right. The rule that whoever put water to use first holds the senior claim, and in a dry year, the senior user is made whole before the junior user gets a drop. It is a doctrine built for rivers that always have enough, and it becomes something colder on a river that doesn't, a seniority list for scarcity, in which the newest rights are written in pencil. The Upper Basin's deepest fear inside that doctrine has a name of its own. The compact call. The moment the lower basin formally demands that the upper basin deliver the full share the 1922 compact promised, even if the snow doesn't come. No compact call has ever been issued, but its shadow sits in every negotiating session the basin has ever held, because the day it arrives, the friendly fiction that the river's promises were approximate becomes a lawsuit over whether they were literal. The Upper Basin states, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, where most of the water actually falls as snow, would let a fixed share flow downstream every year. And the Lower Basin states, Arizona, California, and Nevada, where most of the people and farms are, would get to use it. The bargain worked while there was enough water that nobody had to say no to anybody. It stopped working when the question became, who takes less? The interim guidelines of 2007 answered that question temporarily with a formula tying releases to reservoir levels, and the drought contingency plans of 2019 added voluntary cuts on top. But those were bandages with expiration dates, and the replacement had to be negotiated from scratch, a new formula for a drier river, agreed by all seven states, in which every state accepts a specific reduction. The Upper Basin's position was that its water use is already limited by what the snow gives it, so its cuts should be small or zero. The Lower Basin's position was that the Lower Basin was being asked to bear the entire reduction, while cities and farms downstream of Hoover Dam were already the most efficient water users in the country. Two more parties sit inside this machinery, and both complicate every formula the states ever drafted. The first are the basin's 30 tribal nations, whose water rights are among the oldest and strongest on the river, recognized under a doctrine that reserves water for tribal lands with a priority date of time immemorial, senior to nearly everything the states claim. Many of those rights were quantified late, litigated for decades, or never quantified at all. Adjudication, the formal court process of converting a recognized right into a numbered, enforceable allocation, has taken some nations 50 years and counting, and several tribal governments are still negotiating the settlements and the infrastructure to actually use water they have legally owned for a century. Any framework that allocates scarcity without them is not a framework. It is a lawsuit with a longer fuse. And the tribe's role in whatever replaces the compact is the basin's largest unresolved file. The second party is Mexico, which is owed 1.5 million acre-feet a year under a 1944 treaty, a share that the United States cannot unilaterally cut without an international incident, and which Mexico has already watched shrink through years of negotiated minutes and addenda. The decision framework's cuts stop at the border, the diplomatic channel that has quietly managed the river's international share for 80 years now has to absorb the same arithmetic the states could not solve domestically. The river's final 100 miles, where it once reached the sea and now mostly doesn't, are the ledger entry nobody at the negotiating table owned. There is no formula that makes both of those positions true, and after years of sessions, the states could not produce one. The Secretary of the Interior, citing the need to protect the reservoirs and the infrastructure itself, chose the federal fallback. Decide for them. The decision framework that resulted is worth reading for what it actually does, because its details are the argument. It runs 10 years, from 2027 through 2036, but it is deliberately built as a framework rather than a settlement. It sets principles and boundaries, and then requires the operating guidelines to be rewritten every 2 years, so the numbers can move, as the river does. Its first act is the one with the sharp edge. For 2027 and 2028, the lower basin states collectively take 1.25 million acre-feet per year in reductions, about 21% of their recent use, while the upper basin states take no mandatory cuts at all. The rationale Interior offers is infrastructure protection. Lake Mead and Lake Powell must not fall below the levels at which Hoover and Glen Canyon dams can generate power or release water at all. The asymmetry is not hidden in a footnote. It is printed in the decision itself, which is why the lawsuits were being drafted before the ink on it was dry. The asymmetry is the part that will be litigated and campaigned on for years. The upper basin argues its cut is zero because its use is already snow limited. The lower basin will argue in court that a framework born of a shared river cannot assign the entire first round of pain downstream. Nevada's lawsuit, filed within days of the decision, along with the state's water authorities, attacks the framework on administrative law, environmental review, and the law of the river itself, and it will not be the last suit. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can listen to this story and thousands of others that explore the hidden science and mechanics behind the headlines. Now the arithmetic underneath all of it, because the politics and the lawsuits are scenery compared to the hydrology. 1.25 million acre-feet sounds enormous. It is roughly the annual water use of 5 to 6 million households. But the basin's structural deficit, the gap between what the river delivers and what the rules promise, is larger. The Bureau of Reclamation's own projections show that if the current dry trajectory continues, protecting the reservoirs will require reductions approaching 3 million acre-feet a year, more than double the opening cut. The framework explicitly contemplates escalating toward that number if the water does not come. Which means the opening cuts are not the solution. They are the down payment on a solution, and the mortgage comes due every 2 years when the guidelines are rewritten. There are only three ways the ledger closes. The weather delivers a string of wet years generous enough to refill the reservoirs? Possible, and not the same thing as likely. The basin's water users find savings at a scale that has never been achieved, through fallowing farmland, recycling urban water, pricing, and conservation technology, all of which are real, and all of which are slower than the reservoirs are falling. Or the cuts keep deepening until the pain forces the states back to a table they could not sit at this year. Every water expert in the basin will tell you which of those three they expect. It is not the first one. The second is the one they spend their careers on. The strongest case for the federal takeover deserves to be stated at full strength, because it is genuinely strong. The compact system had its chance, 20 years of interim rules and contingency plans, and the states could not write a replacement even with the reservoirs falling to historic lows. When seven sovereigns cannot agree on shared scarcity, someone must decide, or the infrastructure itself is lost. If Meade or Powell falls below minimum power pool, the dams stop generating, and below Deadpool, they stop releasing water entirely, at which point the lower basin supply is not cut by a fifth, but by catastrophe. Those levels are not abstractions on a chart. Hoover Dam's intakes sit at fixed elevations, carved into the canyon. When the lake falls past them, the machinery of delivery stops, and no treaty, framework, or lawsuit can move water through a dry intake. The federal case rests, in the end, on plumbing. Someone has to keep the reservoirs above the holes in the wall, and if the states cannot agree on who pays for that, the decision cannot wait for their agreement. A federal framework, however contested, at least arrives with an enforcement mechanism and a 2-year review cycle, which is more than the expired guidelines had. And the asymmetry that outrages the lower basin has a defensible logic. The upper basin's use is physically capped by snowfall in a way the lower basin's is not. So mandatory cuts there would be cuts on paper rather than in reality. If the choice is between an unjust framework and no framework at all, the federal government's answer is that a river cannot be run on no framework at all. The strongest case against it is the 104-year lesson. Top-down water decisions in the West do not end fights. They move them into courts and into the next decade's politics. The lawsuit was filed in days. More will follow. A framework that the lower basin experiences as an occupation is a framework its members will spend 10 years trying to escape, renegotiate, or litigate into shape. And a river governed by litigation is a river governed by delay, which is the one input the reservoirs cannot afford. The first developments would disprove the rescue reading or the occupation reading, and each is watchable on a short clock. First, the courts. If Nevada's suit, or its successors, win a stay or vacate the framework, the river reverts to legal limbo, with the old rules expired, and the federal government would be forced either to defend a much deeper emergency intervention or to watch the states try consensus again under deadline pressure, which is the one thing that has never worked, not once in 104 years of trying. Second, the water. If the next two winters deliver average or better snowpack, the framework's 2-year review will be a victory lap, and the escalation clauses will sleep. If the snow fails again, the 3-million-acre-foot conversation begins immediately, and with it, the question of whether any allocation system, federal or state, just or unjust, can survive a river that size. The document is called a framework for a reason. It is built to be replaced by something better, and everyone who signed it knows it. Third, the table. If the framework's existence finally forces the states back into negotiation, with the federal decision as the default nobody wants, then the takeover will have done the one thing the compact era could not, and the framework will be renegotiated into something the states choose rather than something they sue over. Water people in the basin have a name for that outcome. They call it, dryly, the kick in the asterisk. It is worth saying what this article has not claimed. It has not claimed the federal government seized the river permanently. The framework is 10 years, adaptive, and explicitly invites state agreements to supersede it. It has not claimed the cuts are fatal to the lower basin cities. Those cities are the most water efficient in the country, and their preparations for this day are real, however painful. It has not claimed the upper basin is the villain. Its physical argument about snow limits is hydrologically true, even if its political effect is a free pass. And it has not claimed the drought is permanent. It has claimed that the current quarter millennium driest period is the baseline the rules now assume, which is a statement about the planning documents, not a prophecy about the weather. Which returns to October 1st, when the new rules take effect and the river changes hands on paper. For 104 years, the Colorado was run as a treaty organization, seven states and two countries dividing a river by agreement, because the river was big enough that agreement was affordable. The river got smaller, the agreements got harder, and this summer, the agreement died of arithmetic, and the federal government walked into the room. The next two winters will decide whether the takeover was a rescue or an occupation. And the reservoirs, indifferent to both, will keep their own ledger in feet of elevation, written on the canyon walls where everyone can read it. The river, for its part, will keep its own counsel, as it has since long before there were states to argue over it. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create fiction, nonfiction, and turn your documents into audio, all stored in one place, with a single subscription. Plus, get instant access to thousands of audiobooks and deep dive investigations. Learn more today at myaudiobooks.ai. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.